Welcome to Recovery Stories Yukon. The purpose of this podcast is to break stigmas, bring hope, and show that recovery is possible within our communities. Today on the show we have Louie. Louie is from Dawson City, 39 years old, and sober since October 12th, 2023. Welcome, Louie.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, you'd like to share a bit of your journey with addiction and how it started?
Sure, yeah. First time, my experience with drugs and alcohol, you know, going back when I was about 12 years old, grade 7 was the first time I smoked weed. First time I got introduced to anything mind-altering, I guess. And the first time I got high, I actually came to school, which was quite the experience. You know, I liked the effect that it produced. While I was really nervous at school that time, I continued to kind of like use marijuana and, you know, as much as I could kind of since then on. It was fun. All my friends were doing it. And so basically any amount of money that I had at the time, I'd kind of squirrel away and buy like a joint here or there or a gram. And that was kind of what turned into our fun. I remember getting drunk for the first time around 12 years old as well. And I mean, that was, you know, totally just gross, drinking to oblivion and getting sick. By the time I was 16 years old, I remember into high school now, drinking was a regular thing every weekend. Yeah, I just made it a part of my life as soon as it was introduced and got kind of used to doing it and good at it. By the time I graduated high school, you know, and started working in Dawson for the summers, you know, Dawson's a pretty big party town and sun's up all night. And back then, this is, more than 20 years ago, this, you know, there's a lot more transient workers here, a lot wilder parties, drinking till, you know, the wee hours of the morning. I remember I was a breakfast cook, so I'd have to go into work at 6 in the morning, and I had a cutoff. If I didn't get to bed by 3 a.m., I'd have to stay up all night till 5:59 before going into work. Otherwise, I couldn't trust myself to go in on time. I'd sleep past my alarm because I'd be too drunk. So oftentimes, I'd end up just up all night drinking till 5:59, and so you know, all the drinkers would also be going into the restaurant at 6 a.m. to go get breakfast, and we'd be walking there together, and I'd go in the back door, and they'd go in the front door, and God, those were rough days, trying to get through that shift, and, you know, you'd be feeling, like, so bad all day until about, you know, noon, 1 o'clock, and you're off at 2, and all you're thinking about all day is getting off work, and then you're off work finally at 2, and you step out those doors, and the sun is shining, and everybody's waking up, and things are happening again, and you don't really feel like going to bed anymore, and so you kind of get into the mix, and, you know, before you know it, it's 5:59 in the morning again, and you're still up drunk, and it's, that was just normalized here. Yeah, that brings me to my early 20s. And by this time, you know, other drugs started coming in, like ecstasy, MDMA. That was a winter of ecstasy every single weekend. And to the point where, like, I remember waking up puking blood. But, yeah, I had a lot of fun doing it, you know. I liked the feeling that drugs and alcohol kind of produced in me. I'd try to control it as much as I could. Often I couldn't. I found that drinking especially gave me, you know, that liquid courage to be social, to talk to girls. And I'd always feel more comfortable with the drink in my hand. But, you know, when you always have a drink in your hand, you're always drinking it. And it wasn't long in my drinking career that I'd noticed, like, I drank a lot quicker than everybody else. I would probably drink 12 beers by the time somebody drank 6. Doing everything I could to keep my drinking going and keep this little sweet spot going so that I didn't get too drunk and embarrass myself or start puking or get blacked out. And it was always this delicate balance. So consequences weren't quite catching up with me at that point. Still thinking I had this under control. And kind of got my first real career job working at the city here. That just in itself, just getting a job where you only have 4 weeks of holidays in a year and there's no end date, that you're not going to leave after a summer, is like a bit scary on its own. You know, there's any excuse on any night of the week here in Dawson, summers especially, to go drinking, whether it be a thirsty Thursday over at the Triple J or a Soul Sunday at the Sun, or like you name the day of the week. And so I was doing well at work, but there were certain events. I remember one planned overnight shutdown where we were supposed to go into work, shutting the water system down to change a pipe at 3 a.m. And of course, I had gotten drunk the night before and so slept right through it. And my boss was just livid with me in the morning when I walked in late. I was swearing and I was so embarrassed walking there with my tail through my legs. But, you know, by the end of the day, that kind of just was water under the bridge and I carried on. And there was little signs of it being problematic. I guess, you know, progressing through some later years and looking back, this is kind of where I really see first signs of my real problems of my addiction. So I have children. I have a beautiful boy, 7, and a beautiful girl. She's 3 now, but when I first got my partner pregnant, I was still out drinking on the weekends with my buddies. And of course, she's doing the responsible, wonderful thing as a parent and trying to give our unborn child the best chance in life and being as healthy as she can, eating right. She's not drinking. And meanwhile, I'm still going out on the weekends drinking. And sometimes, like, I remember she called sick with her pregnancy and I'm out drinking, but I didn't want to come home to her because I was having too much fun. And so I ignored that call. And then feeling guilty about it, so then the next weekend something's going on and making all the promises with all the earnestness and actually meaning it. Okay, I'm going to be home like 1, 2 a.m. max, you know, I promise this time. I remember being at these parties and looking at that clock and thinking, nope, I'm not going. I don't want to. Consciously making that decision to choose alcohol. And by this point, and this time in my life, drugs as well, like cocaine started becoming around. By my early 30s, it was kind of starting to be around here and there on weekends. And then kind of around every weekend, you know, and then it was, couldn't party without it. Yeah, making promises to my partner to be home, to support her in her pregnancy, and consciously ignoring that after I've gotten drunk and high and not showing up till 6 a.m. time and time and time and time again. I feel horrible about that. And like, she knew I was an alcoholic back then, had many conversations with me about it. I was very resistant to hearing any, you know, critique about my drinking or drugging. You know, I said, this is who you met. This is the person that you fell in love with. You can't change me, blah, blah, blah. How ignorant I was. I wish that I, you know, could have had a little bit more humility. When I first started having children, you know, that's kind of a point in somebody's life where you should probably kind of pull up your socks, you know, maybe change for the better, maybe make some decisions in your life to prioritize more important things than partying like a 20-year-old with your friends till 6 a.m. Yeah, that was the first signs, I'd say, looking back, when my drinking and drugging really became a problem right in my face. And when I really became aware of it, feeling like I didn't have control over it, the first inklings that, you know, why is it that I am making these decisions to not choose to go home when I promise to go home? How is it that I'm prioritizing the same scene that I've been doing for, you know, 25 years now over supporting the love of my life that's pregnant with my child? But, you know, my life on the outside was still fairly good. I had a pretty good job. I progressed through some ranks, had my work. I became a manager, bought a property, built a beautiful house in town, had a family now. You know, I was making money, making good money at work. And, you know, from the outside, I was a pretty successful person, I thought, you know, doing all the right things. But meanwhile, I was still drinking and drugging on the weekends consistently. My relationship with my partner was suffering because of it. When you prioritize drugs and alcohol over your children, over your loved ones, you know, that says something. We eventually got pregnant with our second child and had a girl, like I said, and I don't know whether it was the stress of parenthood, stress of work. Around the time our daughter was one, my cocaine use was problematic. You know, we'd play hockey here on Wednesday nights, and that's also a drinking event. And sometimes we'd go out to the bars or a friend's house afterwards and carry that on till 1, 2, 6 in the morning, whatever. And so I remember one time on Thursday at work, I had a half bag left in my pocket from the night before, feeling like crap. It was almost the end of the day at work, and I was thinking to myself, let's just start a little bit early. So I went and, you know, took a bump in the bathroom, and that kind of just that action of doing drugs at work crossed some line in my morals, in my values, that just allowed me to do that again and again. And it just led to, oh, now I'm feeling tired on a Tuesday. I know how to deal with this. You know, now I want to stay up late on whatever night of the week to get this project done. I know how to deal with that. And so I started using cocaine more and more regularly, in secret, not even with anybody, but just all by myself as a tool to be more awake and productive in my life. And I was very good at operating just normally like this. It became, again, a normal part of my life. I incorporated it just like I did drinking or, you know, smoking weed, and I was very good at hiding it. Nobody knew. I mean, at least I thought, and it was probably true initially. Over the course of, I'd probably say, a year and a half, my cocaine use progressed from couple times a week to daily, a gram a day, up to like 2 or 3 grams a day by the end of it. You know, cocaine's very expensive up here. But I was managing the finances for our home, the being the main breadwinner of our house as well. And so there weren't being a lot of questions asked, but like there were signs that, you know, something was up. I'd constantly be blowing my nose. Sometimes, you know, I'd be in bed for days on end if I was detoxing. I mean, you stay awake and you do that much cocaine every single day. If you stop doing it, you basically have to sleep for 5 days just to kind of be normal. But this is around COVID now, right? And so sometimes I would get COVID and just be in bed for days, quote unquote COVID. But how many times can you get COVID? And, you know, so it got to the point where, like, I had to keep on doing cocaine just to keep on operating. I wasn't ready to be honest about my addiction at that point. And there was no question in my life, I was hopelessly addicted at this point. It didn't happen all at once. It was kind of a gradual progression. It snuck up on me. It slowly built and slowly built and slowly built. And I thought, like, oh, I'll just stop when I want. And I never really realized how powerless and addicted I was until the day I tried to actually stop. I could not. And I was so scared and so hopeless. And I didn't know what to do. I was going broke really fast. And I wasn't ready to be honest with anybody. People knew something was different with me. I was not the same. You can't do that much cocaine and be the same person. I mean, it affects your attitude and your behavior and your emotions. You know, I was pretty much Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde at the time. I was so volatile emotionally, like behaviorally, thank God not violently. You know, my son basically had two dads. He'd never know which one would show up. It's a real big source of shame and guilt in my life still that I'm trying to work through. Year and a half of hidden drug use, built and built and built. By this point, some of my friends were also into drugs, but finding recovery now. And this was kind of my first introduction to maybe there is a solution. I remember seeing a friend of mine have his life kind of get blown up, and his drug of choice was also cocaine. And so, you know, his family almost got broken up, and he had to go off work and into treatment, and seemed like very dramatic consequences, and they moved out of town. All I was thinking was, I wish that could be me, because he's getting the help. He's putting a stop to this insane life that he'd been living, the lies and the manipulation that it all takes to try to keep it going is just exhausting to even think about. The only way I could get help is if I admitted to everybody, to my loved ones, what I was doing. And with that admission would come all the damage, all the hurt and harm of how I've been lying to you and manipulating you and deceiving you. And these are all the tens of thousands of dollars I've spent over the last year and a half. And, you know, I've been driving our children around in our truck, high and drunk, regularly picking them up from daycare, bringing them to my drug dealer's house to score. It's the list goes on and on and on. And like, it would explain a whole lot of behaviors. But I was so filled with fear and scared of the consequences. And so I was stuck in that until I was discovered. Eventually, you know, it all came to a head, as I think it was bound to. It was certainly not a sustainable life. My partner finally sat me down and demanded to see our bank. And there was no hiding it at that point. You know, I was withdrawing hundreds of dollars a day. And so I finally was forced to come clean about all my use. And as damaging and hurtful and harmful as that experience was, telling her everything, it felt so good. I just had the weight of the world lifted off my shoulders. I could finally stop hiding and sneaking around, and I could finally get the help I needed. I was so scared of it, so scared of the harms. And yes, it was harmful. I had to admit to a lot of pains that I had caused a lot of people. And I was so surprised at the grace and the love and the compassion and the caring that I was met with, rather than backlash and anger. I think that was November 2022. I finally was discovered, forced to come clean about my addictions, and that was the beginning of my healing journey. Now, that was not the end of my drug use. And so now I'm seeing a doctor, seeing a counselor, like a community addiction support worker, and I'm waiting to see a psychiatrist. And meanwhile, I'm trying not to use drugs and alcohol. So now starts actually this 8-month window in my life of living hell, because I'm not supposed to be drinking or partying with anybody. I've outed myself or been outed. I'm supposed to be trying to be clean and sober, but I can't. I'm hopelessly addicted still, and I can't stay clean and sober on my own for more than a few days at a time. And I would make all the promises in the world. I'd say, I don't want to do this. I'd flush my drugs. I'd give access to my bank account to my partner so she could see what I was doing. But I would still find ways to go get drugs and sneak around. And now, instead of being able to go to a party on a Friday with my friends, I'm hiding on my own, drinking and snorting cocaine on some mining road in my car. it's now forced me into isolation in my addiction. The drugs are so dangerous these days with fentanyl and benzos in there that, like, doing cocaine alone up some mining road where nobody knows where you are is not a great idea. The ultimate goal is waiting to get into a treatment center. But to do that, I needed to see a psychiatrist and to get a referral from a psychiatrist. There was a 3-month wait for that. Finally saw the psychiatrist. And then there was, he referred me, and there was Yukon Medical travel approvals. Long story short, by the time I finally saw a doctor and the first time I actually went to treatment, I waited 8 months, which is a very long time to wait in that cyclical, hellish life of addiction, trying to quit on your own, hiding it, and just filled with the guilt and shame of knowing that you're breaking all your promises, knowing that you are doing things that you shouldn't be doing, knowing that you're spending your family's money, spending your children's money, spending money that you don't even have for selfish purposes. You know, I went to the detox center in Whitehorse a couple of times during that 8-month period, but the second I would get out of detox, I'd go score in Whitehorse. You know, one time I went down and I spent 2 days in detox and spent the next 5 days just high in Whitehorse and came back and told my family I was in detox for a week. Detox is a great place. You know, it's an amazing initial intervention to get you clean, but that addiction is still very strong after a week. And if you don't have a safe place to go after that week, it's going to be very hard to stay clean. So fast forward to July 2023, I finally get my first chance to go to treatment. And I went to Ravensview. It's an amazing place on Vancouver Island in North Saanich, just north of Victoria. I went there for a 9-week stint, and it was my first time in treatment, and it was amazing. You know, of course, on the way down, I used right up to the point where they picked me up in the Victoria Airport. But this is now my first experience going through recovery alongside other addicts and alcoholics. And that's a very vulnerable time in people's lives. And you get to just take a break from all the stresses in your life, all the temptations, all, you know, your regular environment. And as hard as that is, especially when you have a family and children and obligations, work, it's not easy for a lot of people to have the flexibility to take that kind of time. It's a necessary piece to step away from everything in your life and just prioritize you and get to focus on all the reasons why you drink and drug in the first place. I mean, whether or not, you know, because drinking and drugging is not the problem, it turns out. It's actually the solution that we use to other problems. Typically, it's a coping mechanism. We are using it to avoid, you know, feeling certain situations, avoid our emotions. We're using it to deal with anxieties, traumas. And at treatment, we get to go figure out how to find solutions to those other problems without the use of drinking and drugging. So yeah, my 9 weeks of treatment was an amazing experience. Learned all about all sorts of things. And met a lot of great people along the way, counselors, staff, their clients, and, you know, had a real healthy fear of my addiction still. But coming back from Ravensview, I was now 9 weeks sober. I knew a lot of what to look out for in my life and, you know, knew what I was supposed to do. And so I thought it was going to go okay. You know, I was feeling some pressure to get back to work, feeling some pressure to get back to my family, feeling some pressure to get back to my kids and house and everything like that. And so I was making all those plans to do that. And got home, and meanwhile, 9 weeks away, I'd left my partner's solo parenting, and so she's extra stressed and had been taking on the burden of things while I was gone. And I came back. I was not ready for jumping back. I mean, I was coming off of cloud nine back from treatment, right back into the mix of like a young family and with no support network around me, recovery based in Dawson. I did not practice anything that I had learned coming out of treatment. I was on my own, didn't make any calls when I started feeling upset or stressed, didn't recognize my early warning signs of relapse. They say that relapse happens well before you actually pick up. And if you don't recognize those early warning signs, your brain remembers exactly how to make itself feel good. It knows exactly how we've been doing that for many years by the use of drugs and alcohol. So then all of a sudden you might get this thought, oh, I know how I'm going to get myself out of this feeling. And the second you get that thought, you're into mental relapse and you get from mental to physical and it relapse in about a second. Anyways, I didn't recognize any of that, didn't practice any of my tools or skills that I had picked up in treatment. And I relapsed in about 5 days coming out of the treatment. I did not expect that at all. And was I honest about anything? Was I even honest after I was discovered the first time about the many more times I kept on using? No. Like, I should have been, and that was, I kept on promising to be. It was all because I was fearful of the consequences, fearful of letting people down. You know, I had just taken 2 months off to go to treatment. I was getting the impression from people, well, this better work, you know. I don't want to have to relive that hell that you've put us through in, like, the last 2 years. And this isn't coming from anybody in particular, but these are the feelings or the thoughts that I assign to people in my own head. And so there's a certain amount of pressure that you kind of feel to perform, to be successful after an event like that. So then when you fail, it's a bit natural to not right away be honest, I guess. But that's a big mistake, I'll say right now. You know, the only way you can get help is with the help of other people. So I relapse coming out of treatment. And of course, I'm hiding it again. This time, my family's a little bit more aware of my signs of being high. It only takes about a week or two for them to catch on. Now I'm not living at home anymore, not parenting my children anymore. I'm a liability to them, worrying everybody's sick in my life, snorting cocaine in my car up the mining road all alone again. It's hell on earth again. And I'm super broke. I haven't been working months now. And I don't have any hope of what to do in the future. Like, the Yukon government has just spent all this money to send me to one of the best treatment facilities in the country. And it hasn't worked. And I don't know what to do. And so I spend about a month and a half back in my addiction. And it's just some of the darkest days ever. Totally isolated. Totally avoid my phone, not returning calls, don't reach out to anybody, do all the wrong things. Eventually, my counselor, Mental Wellness Hub here in Dawson, suggests, well, maybe you should go to detox again. I was broke, you know, and I literally couldn't even buy myself a pack of smokes anymore. And I don't know if I would have gone had I had any money still. So I was broke. I couldn't carry on. And I didn't have a plan beyond that first week of detox. Like, I didn't know what I was going to do after I got out of detox. So I go down to Whitehorse, go into the detox center, and it was just good timing or luck or something. I don't know. And I think, anyways, the treatment center in Whitehorse, the Sarah Steele building, is just on the second floor of the same building of the detox center. You know, I get into detox and talking to the staff there, well, there might be a spot upstairs for me in treatment. And I thought, oh man, wow, this is like, yeah, okay, please, like, let's try to make this happen. You know, if you're trying to get into treatment in Whitehorse, I think that this was maybe just timing in their numbers. I think also coming from one of the outside communities, you might also get a little bit more prioritized than the people from Whitehorse. I'm not sure of that. As it happened, I was able to get in upstairs into treatment in the Sarah Steele building right after my stint in detox seamlessly. And so, and I got to say, I had the best experience at that Whitehurst Treatment Center. And I got to really thank some of the other clients that I was in treatment with. They were going to outside meetings, AA and NA meetings in the Whitehurst community. And that was my first experience finding the fellowships. And I got to say, that's probably the difference why I'm sober today versus why treatment the first time didn't work for me. I did not find the 12-step programs at Ravensview. They are available and they are optional. For me, in my experience from healing from addiction, I believe you need the fellowships and you need the 12 steps. And that's what's really going to keep with you for your entire sobriety. And I met other people outside of treatment, just people in Whitehorse who are living in recovery. And I formed friends with these people outside of the treatment center. And so when I finished treatment, I had this community, this group of people that knew me and were looking out for me and who I could rely on and count on who would call me and text me almost every single morning and who I could call in a time of need. And that's been the biggest difference in my recovery and what's probably made the biggest impact in my continuous sobriety. And it's worked. But this time around, you know, like I got to say, we unfortunately learn the hard way in addiction, you know, like nobody can kind of tell you what to do. Everybody's got to find their own bottom and find that gift of desperation. And so when I went to treatment the second time, my greatest asset was my relapse. I knew exactly what not to do coming out of treatment the second time. I knew exactly how truly powerless I was over my addiction, how truly vulnerable I was, and how extreme of steps I needed to take to keep myself safe on the outside this time around. So after I ended up staying in the Sarah Steele building in treatment for a total of 8 weeks, they gave me a 2-week extension just because the timing was around Christmas when I was getting out. And I wanted to come back home to Dawson and spend Christmas time with my family. And when I got out of treatment the second time, I took every precaution, knowing full well how I could not trust myself a single ounce, because I knew my vice is opportunity. And knowing that I was coming back to Dawson, I gave away my bank card and gave away my credit cards. I had no access to finances, which, like, as an almost 40-year-old man, you know, you got to swallow a little bit of pride there, but whatever it takes here, like, I can do that for a little while for a greater purpose here, right? And so I gave away my cards to my mother at Christmas. Anytime I wanted to go buy a pack of smokes, I'd have to ask her to come with me. I was also never left alone for a single moment. If I wanted to go to an AA meeting here, I'd have to get picked up, dropped off at the meeting, and then picked up again at the end of the meeting and driven home. And it worked, you know, like it wasn't the most pleasant life. I couldn't go to Christmas parties. I did start feeling a little bit down, but mostly I got to spend a month with my kids at Christmas. I was home every day. It filled my heart, and I had been absent in their lives for almost a year at that point, with, like, in the worst of my addiction and it going through the treatment. And so it was an amazing time. I didn't care if I had to give away my own free will and independence because I was a recovering addict. Oh, who cares, as long as the solution worked. I knew that I couldn't spend my winter in Dawson. Dawson's, you know, it's a hard place to be sober here. There's not a lot of people in recovery doing it here. So that was another big part of my plan. And I spent a lot of time while I was in treatment in Whitehorse setting this up. Is I moved out to Vancouver in January, and I moved into a sober living house operated by an organization called Together We Can. Amazing organization. They operate a number of treatment facilities. They progress people through primary treatment and then eventually on to second stage. And so second stage is the sober living piece, where you've graduated from a primary treatment program, you pay for your room and board, and you have to be productive and kind of advancing in your life. So that means you're either working, volunteering, or in school. And you're randomly drug tested, so you're kept accountable. One service that the Yukon could really benefit from having that it currently doesn't have is a second stage treatment facility or a sober living house for people so that they don't have to leave the territory to access this. And once I got down there, I found out about a volunteer opportunity at Together We Can's main treatment center, which is just perfect. So like I didn't necessarily need to be working. I was on disability away from my regular job. I was very fortunate that way. So my financial situation was okay. I started volunteering at the men's treatment center there 4 or 5 days a week. And I spent my winter living in a sober house, volunteering at a men's treatment center, and going to about 10 or 15 meetings a week in the Vancouver, you know, city. So like whether that be AA meetings, NA meetings, or CA meetings, Cocaine Anonymous meetings. So that was just like the most amazing recovery experience I could have ever hoped for. I mean, I didn't even think about drinking or drugging. It was like nowhere even in the picture at that point. My life was just nothing but recovery. You know, when I was volunteering at the treatment center, working with the newcomers, coming in, still detoxing there, and sharing my experience, strength, and hope. You know, and so still, now coming back to Dawson, I am still getting used to regular life. I'm not, you know, limiting my independence in the community anymore. I can go sit in a bar on a patio, enjoy non-alcoholic beer if I choose in the sun, be social with friends. You know, it's not all easy sailing. I'm 9 months sober 2 days ago. There's not nearly as many meetings, not nearly as big of a recovery community. You know, there's one in-person AA meeting a week here in Dawson. I was used to going to two a night in Vancouver. It's like night and day coming from that scene in Vancouver back to Dawson. But, you know, I've heard it said, I mean, life doesn't get easier in recovery. We just get stronger. Having given myself that chance, giving myself that 6-7 months of treatment time, recovery time, and committed myself to that process before really facing my real life again, it's been a big sacrifice. If you had asked me the first time around whether I was willing to take that kind of time off to commit to my recovery, I probably would have said I can't. Like, I have obligations, I have work, I have kids, I can't step away. You know, I had to learn the hard way. I had to learn just how serious it was to commit all of myself to this before I could come to that realization. And unfortunately, we end up learning the hard way. So trying and failing, don't ever give up. Just pick yourself up and try again. You know, my experience in these treatment centers, having gone to a couple myself and then volunteered in a third one, I've seen hundreds of clients, like men, women, old, young, people from all walks of life. Addiction touches us all. It's rich and poor. It's got no filter, but it rarely works for anybody the first time. So please, like, keep coming back. That's the most important thing.
Louis, how have your relationships changed with your friends and loved ones since you've returned?
Yeah, well, drastically. Unfortunately, you know, relationships have to change. A lot of our relationships in life were based around drugs and alcohol. For me, my family have been very supportive. My partner and I, the hell that I put her through in the 2 years of my addiction and recovery, that's changed a lot. A lot of my friends in town are still my friends. I'm just getting back into kind of seeing them, to be honest. It's hard. I've been a little bit isolated because I'm scared to put myself in situations that'll tempt me to drink and drug. But I'm slowly getting back into it. Like, actually just last night, I went to a party with a bunch of old friends. They were all drinking, and I was not. And I was just as happy to be sitting alongside them, laughing and sharing in the fun. And that was okay for me. But again, like I said, like, we get stronger. There are certain people, though, that I've absolutely had to cut completely out of my life, because I just know that they're still in that life, and I can be nowhere near it.
What are your main resources in your sobriety that really help?
Again, I'm still not perfect at reaching out when I should, but I would say the contacts I've made through the fellowships, whether that be just friends that I've met in AA or NA. Yeah, going to meetings is probably what keeps me sober the most. I've never been a religious person, but in recovery, it's almost impossible to not find spirituality and, you know, sort of like a higher meaning in life. Nobody can sober up on their own. That's my firm belief.
What would you say that you're most grateful for in your sobriety?
In the end, I will have been grateful for my addictions. It's hard when thinking about this because there has been so many harms done to others. But in the process of me having fallen into addiction and gone through the trenches and, you know, been able to pick myself up and now here sharing my story, maybe helping another person find their path to recovery, just being able to find the tools for myself to become a better person in life, I would have never been able to find that had it not been for my addictions. And so it's a funny thing to be grateful for, but I am grateful to have gone through it.
Louis, thank you so much for being here today and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Capri. It's been an honor.
Thank you for listening. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, you can get help by calling the Yukon Government Mental Wellness and Substance Use Services at 1-866-456-3838. Or by reaching out to Theki Anate, Fly Like an Eagle program, at 867-333-2497. If you would like to share your story on this podcast, please email recoverystoriesyukon@gmail.com.